From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
Tonight, our show is dedicated to Tom Lehrer. Tom Lehrer was a Harvard-trained mathematician who taught for many years at UC Santa Cruz. He taught math there, but also he had a class devoted to the American musical theater. Of course, he was also famous for the iconoclastic songs that made him a favorite satirist of the 1950s and 60s on records, in nightclubs, and in concerts all over the country and all around the world. Tom Lehrer died on July 26, 2025, in his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He was 97. A little later on, we will hear from a few of his former students. But first, I want to share with you an appearance that he made here with me on From the Bookshelf back in 2006. So here's From the Bookshelf with Tom Lehrer.
Tonight, I am very pleased to have as my guest the living legend, Mr. Tom Lehrer. Tom has been called the most brilliant creative genius that America has produced in almost 200 years. In fact, I believe that quote is from Tom himself. Tonight, Professor Lehrer will be reading selections from the writings of John Cage and a few selections from and a story about Ambrose Bierce. Tom Lehrer, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
I'm glad to be here, Gary. Well, first a little background on John Cage. He was born in Los Angeles in 1912 and died in New York in 1992. He's primarily known as an extremely idiosyncratic avant-garde musician and composer, famous for many quirky musical innovations. For example, the prepared piano, in which he placed various objects between the strings to create new percussion sounds, and aleatoric music, in which the toss of a coin or the roll of a die was used to determine the next note or the next whatever. He also wrote a piece for 12 radios, and another one which consisted of exactly 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. Well, you get the idea. In addition to his music, though, he was a prolific writer, and among his books are two called Silence and A Year from Monday, which contain many brief, largely unconnected paragraphs, stories, anecdotes, and random thoughts. 186 of these are collected at a website called Indeterminacy, which is where I got them. His life partner was the dancer and choreographer Merce Cunningham, and one of the pieces occasionally performed by Merce Cunningham's dance company involved John Cage himself sitting at a table at the side of the stage with a bottle of wine and a glass. In between sips, he would read some of these stories. Each one was supposed to be exactly 1 minute long. If they were short, he read them slowly, and if they were long, he read them rapidly. The dancers would be on stage dancing as he read. The dances were not related to the stories, by the way. Now, I'm going to read 26 of these items tonight in the first half of the program, but I won't do it the way he did, that is, at varying speeds, since that might prove rather tedious on radio, especially without the dancers. So, with one exception, I'll just read them all at more or less the same speed. Now, it may not always be obvious when a story ends, so to help you out, I'm going to ring this bell after each one. Here goes. An Indian lady invited me to dinner and said Dr. Suzuki would be there. He was. After dinner, the talk turned to metaphysical problems, and there were many questions, for the hostess was a follower of a certain Indian yogi, and her guests were more or less equally divided between allegiance to Indian thought and to Japanese thought. About 11 o'clock, an American lady said, "How is it, Dr. Suzuki, we spend the evening asking you questions and nothing is decided?" Dr. Suzuki smiled and said, "That's why I love philosophy. No one wins." When Sri Ramakrishna was asked, "Why, if God is good, is there evil in the world?" he replied, "To thicken the plot." Arnold Schoenberg asked a girl in his class to go to the piano and play the first movement of a Beethoven sonata, which was afterwards to be analyzed. She said, "It is too difficult. I can't play it." Schoenberg said, "You're a pianist, aren't you?" She said, "Yes." He said, "Then go to the piano." She did. She had no sooner begun playing than he stopped her to say that she was not playing at the proper tempo. She said that if she played at the proper tempo, she would make mistakes. He said, "Play at the proper tempo and do not make mistakes." She began again, and he stopped her immediately to say that she was making mistakes. She then burst into tears and between sobs explained that she had gone to the dentist earlier that day and that she'd had a tooth pulled out. He said, "Do you have to have a tooth pulled out in order to make mistakes?" One day when I was studying with Schoenberg, he pointed out the eraser on his pencil and said, "This end is more important than the other." One spring morning, I knocked on Sonia Sekula's door. She lived across the hall. Presently, the door was opened just a crack, and she said quickly, "I know you're very busy. I won't take a minute of your time." One day, when I was across the hall visiting Sonia Sekula, I noticed that she was painting left-handed. I said, "Sonia, aren't you right-handed?" She said, "Yes, but I might lose the use of my right hand, and so I'm practicing using my left." I laughed and said, "What if you lose the use of both hands?" She was busy painting and didn't bother to reply. Next day, when I visited her, she was sitting on the floor, painting with difficulty, for she was holding the brush between two toes of her left foot. Several years ago, I was talking with Hidekazu Yoshida. I mentioned the book called Zen in the Art of Archery. The melodramatic climax of this book concerns an archer's hitting the bullseye, though he did so in total darkness. Yoshida told me there was one thing the author failed to point out, that is, there lives in Japan at the present time a highly esteemed archer who has never yet been able to hit the bullseye, even in broad daylight. Sometime after my father's death, I was talking with Mother. I suggest she take a trip west to visit the relatives. I said, "You'll have a good time." She was quick to reply, "Now, John, you know perfectly well that I've never enjoyed having a good time." George Mantor had an iris garden, which he improved each year by throwing out the commoner varieties. One day, his attention was called to another very fine iris garden. Jealously, he made some inquiries. The garden, it turned out, belonged to the man who collected his garbage. Merce Cunningham's father delights in gardening. Each year he has had to move the shrubs back from the driveway to protect them from being run over when Mrs. Cunningham backs out. One day Mrs. Cunningham, in backing out, knocked down but did not hurt an elderly gentleman who had been taking a stroll. Getting out of her car and seeing him lying on the sidewalk, Mrs. Cunningham said, "What are you doing there?" Merce Cunningham's parents were going to Seattle to see their other son, Jack. Mrs. Cunningham was driving. Mr. Cunningham said, "Don't you think you should go a little slower? You'll get caught." He gave this warning several times. Finally, they were stopped by a policeman. He asked to see Mrs. Cunningham's license. She rummaged around in her bag and said, "I just don't seem to be able to find it." He then asked to see the registration. She looked for it, but unsuccessfully. The officer then said, "Well, what are we going to do with you?" Mrs. Cunningham started the engine. Before she drove off, she said, "I just don't have any more time to waste talking with you. Goodbye." Once I was visiting my Aunt Marge. She was doing her laundry. She turned to me and said, "You know, I love this machine much more than I do your Uncle Walter." Just the other day, I went to the dentist. Over the radio, they said it was the hottest day of the year. However, I was wearing a jacket because going to the doctor has always struck me as a somewhat formal occasion. In the midst of his work, Dr. Hyman stopped and said, "Why don't you take your jacket off?" I said, "I have a hole in my shirt, and that's why I have my jacket on." He said, "Well, I have a hole in my sock, and if you like, I'll take my shoes off." Virgil Thompson and Maurice Grosser were driving across the United States. When they came to Kansas, Virgil Thompson said, "Drive as fast as possible. In no case stop. Keep on going until we get out of it." Maurice Grosser got hungry and insisted on stopping for lunch. Seeing something at the end of the counter, he asked what it was, and the waitress replied, "Peanut butter pie." Virgil Thompson said, "You see what I mean?" Now, I can't resist inserting here the fact that during the recent presidential campaign of John Edwards, his website actually announced that if you sent in a specified contribution to the campaign, Edwards' mother would email you her recipe for peanut butter pie. Okay, back to John Cage. A depressed young man came to see Hazel Dryce. He said, "I've decided to commit suicide." She said, "I think it's a good idea. Why don't you do it?" A married couple I knew were lifelong anarchists. When I heard that they had adopted two small boys, I wondered whether this experience had affected them in any way, and so I went to visit them. After the boys had left the room, the husband said to me, "We finally had to draw the line somewhere. No jumping on the beds." A crowded bus on the point of leaving Manchester for Stockport was found by its conductress to have one too many standees. She therefore asked who was the last person to get on the bus. No one said a word. Declaring that the bus would not leave until the extra passenger was put off, she went and fetched the driver, who also asked, "All right, who was the last person to get on the bus?" Again, there was a public silence. So the two went to find an inspector. He asked, "Who was the last person to get on the bus?" No one spoke. He then announced that he would fetch a policeman. While the conductress, driver, and inspector were away looking for a policeman, a little man came up to the bus stop and asked, "Is this the bus to Stockport?" Hearing that it was, he got on. A few minutes later, the three returned, accompanied by a policeman. He asked, "What seems to be the trouble? Who was the last person to get on the bus?" The little man said, "I was." The policeman said, "All right, get off." All the people on the bus burst into laughter. The conductress, thinking they were laughing at her, burst into tears and said she refused to make the trip to Stockport. The inspector then arranged for another conductress to take over. She, seeing the little man standing at the bus stop, said, "What are you doing there?" He said, "I'm waiting to go to Stockport." She said, "Well, this is the bus to Stockport. Are you getting on or not?" A Chinaman, Kwangse tells us, went to sleep and dreamed he was a butterfly. Later, when he awoke, he asked himself, "Am I a butterfly dreaming that I am a man?" A composer friend of mine, who spent some time in a mental rehabilitation center, was encouraged to do a good deal of bridge playing. After one game, his partner was criticizing his play of an ace on a trick which had already been won. My friend stood up and said, "If you think I came to the loony bin to learn to play bridge, you're crazy." I went to a concert in Town Hall. The composer whose works were being performed had provided program notes. One of these notes was to the effect that there is too much pain in the world. After the concert, I was walking along with the composer, and he was telling me how the performances had not been quite up to snuff. So I said, "Well, I enjoyed the music, but he didn't agree with that program note about there being too much pain in the world." He said, "What? Don't you think there's enough?" I said, "I think there's just the right amount." One of Mies van der Rohe's pupils came to him and said, "I have difficulty studying with you because you don't leave any room for self-expression." He asked her whether she had a pen with her. She did. He said, "Sign your name." She did. He said, "That's what I call self-expression." After an hour or so in the woods, looking in vain for mushrooms, Dad said, "Well, we can always go and buy some real ones." An Eskimo lady who couldn't speak or understand a word of English was once offered free transportation across the United States, plus $500, providing she would accompany a corpse that was being sent back to America for burial. She accepted. On her arrival, she looked about and noticed that people who went into the railroad station left the city, and she never saw them again. Apparently, they traveled someplace else. She also noticed that before leaving, they went to the ticket window, said something to the salesman, and got a ticket. She stood in line, listened carefully to what the person in front of her said to the ticket salesman, repeated what that person said, and then traveled wherever he traveled. In this way, she moved about the country from one city to another. After some time, her money was running out, and she decided to settle down in the next city she came to find employment and to live there the rest of her life. But when she came to this decision, she was in a small town in Wisconsin from which no one that day was traveling. However, in the course of moving about, she had picked up a bit of English. So finally, she went to the ticket window and said to the man there, "Where would you go if you were going?" He named a small town in Ohio, where she lives to this day. Standing in line, Max Jacob said, gives one the opportunity to practice patience. I went to hear Krishnamurti speak. He was lecturing on how to hear a lecture. He said, "You must pay full attention to what is being said, and you can't do that if you take notes." The lady on my right was taking notes. The man on her right nudged her and said, "Don't you hear what he's saying? You're not supposed to take notes." She then read what she had written and said, "That's right. I have it written down right here in my notes." Two monks were walking along one day when they came to a stream where a young lady was waiting, hoping that someone would help her across. Without hesitating, one of the monks picked her up and carried her across, putting her down safely on the other side. The two monks continued walking along, and after some time, the second one, unable to restrain himself, said to the first, "You know we're not allowed to touch women. Why did you carry that woman across the stream?" The first monk replied, "Put her down. I did 2 hours ago." You have just heard, assuming you were listening, some stories by John Cage, and you can find all 186 stories at the website www.lcdf.org/indeterminacy. That's www.lcdf.org/indeterminacy.
We're done with the dancers. We can have the dancers.
Oh, the dancers could go now, yes. Oh, thank you very much. Yes, yes. See the girl for your check. Let's turn our attention now to another American iconoclast, the writer Ambrose Bierce. Here is a very brief biography. Ambrose Bierce was born in Ohio in 1842. He served as an officer in the Union Army during the Civil War. By 1866, he was in California, where he lived for many years, contributing to various local newspapers and writing stories, the most famous of which is An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge. For many years, he wrote a column in the San Francisco Examiner. Between 1887 and 1906, he included in his column numerous sardonic definitions, which were published in 1906 under the title The Cynic's Word Book. When the book was republished in 1911, it was retitled The Devil's Dictionary, which became perhaps his best-known work. In 1913, at the age of 71, Bierce disappeared into Mexico, where a civil war was raging. His end remains unknown, although it is generally believed that he died in Mexico in 1914. My favorite Bierce quote is not from The Devil's Dictionary, but from a capsule book review he once wrote in which he said, "The covers of this book are too far apart." I like that. Here are just a few definitions from The Devil's Dictionary. Bore, a person who talks when you wish him to listen. Conservative, a statesman who is enamored of existing evils as distinguished from the liberal who wishes to replace them with others. Egotist, a person more interested in himself than in me. Lawyer, one skilled in circumvention of the law. Patriot, one to whom the interests of a part seem superior to those of the whole, the dupe of statesmen and the tool of conquerors. Politics, a strife of interests masquerading as a contest of principles, the conduct of public affairs for private advantage. To pray, to ask that the laws of the universe be annulled in behalf of a single petitioner confessedly unworthy. Wit, the salt with which the American humorist spoils his intellectual cookery by leaving it out. And on a personal note, let me add that that last definition, although it was written about 100 years ago, is still appropriate today when comedy is ubiquitous, but wit, alas, is still in short supply. Now, have you ever tried to imagine what might happen if some famous author, say Melville or Whitman or even Shakespeare, were to return from the dead and read some of the dubious analysis and misguided criticism of his work that had been excreted by scholars since his death? He would then, of course, be in a unique position to refute such scholars. Well, here's a story that imagines just that. It's called The Mystery of Ambrose Bierce. It was written by Morris Bishop and was first published in The New Yorker on February 26, 1949. Incidentally, there are three more Bierce definitions in this story. No prizes for spotting them, though. The Mystery of Ambrose Bierce by Morris Bishop. At a recent meeting of the Modern Language Association, for which professors of literature from all over the country had gathered in a large New York hotel, I happened on my old friend F. Bishop just gives the initial here. Over cups of aseptic coffee in the clinical atmosphere of the hotel coffee shop, F. told me a really rather remarkable story. F. is the great authority on Ambrose Bierce, that strange genius who wrote some brutal stories of our Civil War and a mass of cynical and epigrammatic commentaries on human behavior, and who disappeared mysteriously in Mexico in 1914. Well, F. got his doctorate on Bierce and published a weighty biography of him, and he comes out every year with a paper on the aesthetic validity of Bierce's criticism, or the ego and unconscious in Bierce's symbolism, that sort of thing. In academic circles, F. is commonly referred to as the big Bierce man. His only rival in the field is Q. of Yale University, who is regarded as the coming Bierce man. According to F., he was sitting cozily at home one winter evening, meditating a little article on imagery in Bierce and Poe. His wife was at some high-minded community welfare meeting, and F. was congratulating himself on being alone with his thoughts when he was disturbed by the imperious ringing of the doorbell. Grumbling, he answered it. On the doorstep stood an old man, a very old man. His clothes hung loose upon his frame, and the skin of his face hung as loose upon the underlying bone. He spoke.
"You, no doubt, are the young fellow who has been writing all that swill about me," he said.
"What? Who? No," said F.
"Certainly. Ambrose Bierce. Shall we enter?"
The old man said. Dully, my friend led the visitor to the living room and settled him in an armchair. "Then you weren't killed in Mexico," F. said, after a moment of speechlessness.
"Not entirely," the old man chuckled toothlessly. "I was wounded in an argument with one of Villa's boys. Some kind Indians took me in and cared for me during my year of convalescence. I found myself happy among the Indians. The high, dry climate cured my asthma and seemed to preserve me from decay. On our drowsy butte were no editors, no duties, no law, no time. I had spent my life attacking the fetid civilization of North America, and when I found myself quit of it, I saw no purpose in returning to it voluntarily. I think this was the happiest stage of that period in which I have been permitted to befoul the Earth's surface."
"Then why did you leave?" asked F.
"Well, of course, a lot of American hunters and ethnologists would come through," said the old man, "and young fellows on Guggenheim fellowships, and they would leave papers and magazines around. I happened on a review of your book and sent for it. It cost me a couple of fine turquoises, and a worse lot of balderdash and poppycock I never saw. So I thought I would run up and set you right on a few points. Cold around here."
"Would you like a drink?"
"I would indeed. Have you any tequila?"
"No, but I have some pretty good whiskey," said F. defensively.
"That will do, though I am rather out of the habit. Now, about this book of yours. Take, for example, the Civil War chapter. The facts are mostly wrong, but that's a minor matter. Your theme throughout is the disillusionment of the idealist. Balderdash and poppycock, my young gosling. Now, in fact..."
In fact, according to F., it was a catastrophe. The old man, tossing off his whiskey and rattling the ice cubes, took F.'s precious balloons of theory, one by one, punctured and slashed them, and jumped gleefully on the ragged remnants. With allegations of fact, with calm assertions, he destroyed in an hour F.'s orderly critical structure. Then, smiling among the ruins of a scholar's life work, and more than half drunk, the old man fell asleep. F. carried the light old body to the guest room, undressed it, and put it to bed. He admits that he felt a horrible impulse to tie a pillow over the hard-breathing mouth. He broke the news to his wife on her return from her meeting. Trained to efficiency in the hard school of community welfare, she came immediately to her own conclusion. "He's an imposter," she declared. "He's just a smart old bum who has read your book and decided to settle down and live off you for the rest of his life." "He's extraordinarily well informed on Bierce's life."
"So are you, and you aren't Bierce."
"If he isn't Bierce, who is he?"
"I'll bet he's an old unfrocked professor of English."
"But if he is Bierce..."
"I won't have him in my house anyhow," said Mrs. F. "Look here. Bierce was born in 1842, wasn't he? He'd be over 100 now. It's impossible."
"Not quite impossible. Not if you think of his spending the last 30 years practically motionless on the high Mexican desert."
"Does he look like Bierce?" said Mrs. F.
"Well, he could be Bierce," admitted F. "Of course, the famous sorrel hair is gone, and the mustache, and he's shorter, but still, he could be." "I'll find out the truth tomorrow," his wife assured him. "Don't worry." The next morning, Mrs. F. greeted her guest at breakfast with marked hauteur, to which he was insensitive. He groaned and patted his old head tenderly.
"That whiskey was poor cheap stuff," he said. "I must insist on 10-year-old straight bourbon, bottled in bond. Right after breakfast, my young friend, you might telephone for a hearse." "A hearse, death's baby carriage."
"And a bartender to perform the last rites." "I could get you some medicine," said F. "I have kind of bromide."
"No medicine. What is medicine? A stone flung down the Bowery to kill a dog in Broadway.
Really, that's very good, said Mrs. F. I like that. Would you write that down for me, Mr. Beers? I should like to put it in my memory book.
Thank you, Mrs. F., but I have renounced writing. Writing I regard merely as a device for prolonging the life of lies. Hence, it is the first thing we teach our children in the public schools.
The old man accepted a drink of whiskey as a restorative and became very talkative. He told the plots of a couple of Civil War stories he had never put into writing. They were thoroughly Beersian. One dealt with a wounded Union soldier who was gradually devoured by chickens. Suddenly, his chin fell onto his breast, and he was asleep. F. carried him gently to the living room sofa.
I see you won't get any handwriting from him, said F. to his wife.
I have been applying the scholarly tests for genuineness to his conversation. Two of his epigrams were authentic, from his works, but one was spurious.
And what does that prove? Asked Mrs. F.
Nothing, I fear. If he is Bierce, he has a right to make a new epigram. And if he is not, a Bierce-like epigram does not prove him a faker.
I'm going to search him, said Mrs. F., a woman of character.
With F. unhappily watching, she went through the old man's pockets. They were literally empty, except for some slightly indecent pictures and one of F.'s handkerchiefs. The ancient awoke as suddenly as he had gone to sleep.
Find anything? He said pleasantly.
How does it happen that you got into this country without a passport and without money? Said Mrs. F.
Easy. The Indians brought me over the border, and I hitchhiked and begged for food. I'm a beggar, yes. But what is a beggar if not one who has relied on the assistance of his friends?
Then presumably you could hitchhike back, Mrs. F. said.
Presumably. But to tell you the truth, I'm beginning to find the Pueblo damnably cold in winter. I'm really better off here. The breakfast was good, though it would have been improved by some chili and red peppers.
Mrs. F. looked at him glumly.
And may I ask how long you are planning to be our guest? She asked. I have no fixed plans, but I want to visit young Q of Yale University. He has written some articles about me. Even worse than yours, my dear fellow, he said, turning to F. So I came to see you first. He claims I was deeply influenced by Schopenhauer. I've never read a word of Schopenhauer.
F.'s hitherto contained anger exploded.
Do you think it's right to go around the country at your age telling scholars they are liars?
How do you expect us to assess literary values with any sort of finality if the authors are going to pop up out of the tomb and upset everything? The old man grinned.
I expect young Q to be sympathetic when I put the case to him. I think he will find it wiser to champion my cause than to oppose me. By the way, Mrs. F., I am accustomed to an early lunch in the Pueblo. And put plenty of chili in it.
F.'s position was indeed a hard one. If he should present his guest to the world as Bierce, he would share in a journalistic sensation and might even get his picture into the news weeklies. However, among the scholars, his reputation would be cruelly impugned, for when the reporters interviewed Bierce, most of F.'s critical theories would be proved false. And then if young Q should demonstrate that the old man was an impostor, F. would be regarded either as a dupe or an accomplice, and not the sort of sound scholar who ought to be promoted to a full professorship. One morning, when the F.'s came down to breakfast, the old man was gone. Mrs. F. took full credit for his disappearance.
I found a very simple way, she said, smiling over the coffee. I just gave him $50 to go away. That proves he was only an old drunken bum.
But he'll just go straight to Q, cried her husband.
No, he won't. He'll get roaring drunk first.
And then he'll come back for more money. That's what comes of yielding to blackmail.
Maybe, said Mrs. F., but he's so old. These bitter cold nights.
There was a pause. All these wild drivers around, reflected F. Another silence.
He's old enough to take care of himself, said Mrs. F. sharply.
The old gentleman did not return. Discreet inquiries seemed to show that he never visited Q. F. watched the papers closely but learned nothing, although he noted that the usual number of old men were being killed on the roads.
To sum up, we are faced by a puzzling dilemma. Either the stranger was Bierce, and the biography of Bierce must be rewritten, or he was not Bierce, and an impostor is at large who threatens the security of all literary judgments and even the well-being of the Modern Language Association.
The dilemma may be indeed a trilemma. For, to be perfectly frank, F. is a very unreliable scholar, a good deal of a romancer, with a taste for coarse, Beercean comedy. I wouldn't believe anything he says unless it was corroborated by recorded evidence. One might go further and call the trilemma a tetralemma, for the fact is,
I am not very trustworthy myself. That was The Mystery of Ambrose Bierce by Morris Bishop, written in 1949. And if you want to know more about either John Cage or Ambrose Bierce, I suggest you Google them. There's lots of interesting stuff out there.
And you've been listening to Tom Lehrer tonight on From the Bookshelf. Tom, thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you, Gary. Have a good time.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. That was Tom Lehrer, recorded in 2006. Tom Lehrer had a class that he taught at UC Santa Cruz called American Musical Theater, in which he would audition a hand-picked group of students, and in the course of a 10-week quarter, he would put on 5 full-length musicals, in which he would accompany the performers on piano, and the students would perform the show at the Stevenson Coffee House in front of an audience. And I was one of the students in that class, and I contacted a couple of other people so that you could hear our reminiscences of our time with Tom Lehrer. Joining me now is jazz singer Judy Wexler, and she's recently released her 7th album, I believe, and she is really great. She's performed all over the world while I've been sitting at home in my bathrobe. Judy Wexler, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks, Gary. Long time no see, and it's good to be with you.
It's lovely to see you. And the reason I asked you here today is we're talking about our friend Tom Lehrer, who passed away this week. And you were in Tom Lehrer's musical comedy workshop when you went to college at UCSC, right?
Yeah.
I mean, were you familiar with Tom Lehrer before you took his class?
Oh, my God, yes. My parents, you know, the whole family played the music. I knew the music pretty well by the time I met him.
Yeah.
We were all fans. Absolutely.
Yes, the same with me. I mean, I'd grown up with this music, and then I thought, well, I wonder if I'll get a chance to meet him, you know, when I was going to UCSC. And then, oh, I could audition for the class. I wonder if I would get in. And for my audition, I sang a song called Don Jose from Far Rockaway by Harold Rome.
Oh, I love Harold Rome. Okay, great. That's perfect for him.
And I got in. And we also did 5 musicals, just like you did. And I think one of our musicals was the same, which was Gypsy.
Right. And who were you in Gypsy?
I played Tulsa, so I had to sing that song, All I Need Now Is the Girl.
The girl,
and
yeah.
And I had trouble singing it because I can't sing, and also because there's a part where the song goes really high, this big town for a whirl. And it's like really impossible to hit.
And, great song.
Yeah, and I couldn't do it. And I said, well, could you transpose it? And he said, no.
He's not a jazz player.
You'll have to learn to sing it. And, you know, he worked with me and found a way to get me to hit that note. I only had to do it once. So.
But you know what I learned? I mean, I learned things. But one of the things that I really learned was, you know, they were all levels of singers, and some people who were absolutely non-singers had never sung anything, but they could sell a song. Yeah. And in my observation, it was like, wow, you don't actually, I mean, for some of this, you don't need to be a great singer. You just got to sell the song because everybody was good.
So in your class with Tom Lehrer, Gypsy was the one that you had the lead in. You played
yes.
Mama Rose, and that's like an enormous part. Do you remember?
Do you remember
the night that you performed it?
I do remember. I do. I remember bits and pieces of it. Yes, I do.
And do you remember spending time with Tom in the rehearsal room?
Yes, I do remember that.
It's amazing.
It was a lot of fun because, you know, he was, I think it was only him playing piano, right?
That's right.
Was the accompaniment.
Yeah, that was it.
There were no bass and drums.
Just Tom playing piano. Yes, and he played piano with each musical production, and he worked with all of us, you know, he put in a lot of time in this thing.
He did. I mean, when I think about it, it's kind of amazing how much he must have worked. And then he had his other classes, his math classes.
His math classes. I took his math class as well.
You did?
Yes.
Yeah. Is he funny at all in those?
Very funny.
He was.
See, one of my problems was, you know, in addition to not being able to sing, I cannot do math at all. I zero math. And I was going to get my teaching credential, and in order to get my credential, I had to take, in order to pass this test, I had to know something. And so I took his class, which is called The Nature of Mathematics. Then I took the test immediately after the class, and I scored higher on the math test than I scored on the other stuff. And I was, you know, going for an English social studies credential, which I got, but I had scored higher on the math than on the English.
Well, do you think he had anything to do with that?
He had everything to do with it because, you know, so I learned it, took the test, and immediately forgot it, and I don't know anything about it. I don't know anything
about it. Well, it's, you know, as Peggy Sue, and Peggy Sue got married, she said, well, I know for a fact I'll never need algebra.
That's right.
That's right. There you go.
But that was the thing about him. I mean, he, Tom Lehrer put in so much time with us, and but you did socialize with him, you know.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, and he was fun.
He was very fun.
You want to go into detail or not?
Do you want me to go into detail?
Yes, I do.
When I went, it was the 70s and mid 70s. And there were many students who were into psychedelics. And I remember going to Tom's apartment. Was it an apartment or a house?
Yeah, apartment. An apartment, yeah, on the beach.
And we were going to take MDA, which is really a fabulous psychedelic. And it promotes euphoria and heightens compassion. So I think there's a whole half of America that should be on it right now. And, but anyway, so what I do remember is there were two other guys, me and Tom, and since I am a very petite person, and so he said, you know, Judy, you're very small, so I'm just going to give you half the dose. And so I had taken it before, so I knew what the effect was, and I enjoyed it very, very, very much. And so basically we walked through the forest, all four of us, and we were, I think it was a very intellectual conversation, actually. I don't remember the conversation, but I remember everybody was pretty smart.
Unknown caller.
Sorry about that. And, so I really didn't feel much on that excursion.
Because of the half dose that he gave you?
Yeah, because, you know, dosing has nothing to do with your body size.
No? And what does it have to do with?
It has to do completely with your body chemistry.
Oh, I see. And
so,
you could handle it all.
Oh, absolutely. And well, then some.
Yeah. Well, those are some interesting experiences. And Judy Wexler, thank you so much for sharing them with us here on From the Bookshelf. And just so people know, they can find out more about you at judywexler.com. That's your website, and tells people where you're going to be performing and how to get your records and all those things.
Thank you, Gary. It's so good to see you and to have this interview and talk to you again.
Nice to reminisce with you.
Yeah.
Josiah Bolimus is an actor, a director, and he has appeared in numerous films and TV shows, including Mad Men and a lot of other things. He's a podcast actor, and he was in Tom Lehrer's History of Musical Comedy class about 40 years ago or so.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, exactly.
Josiah Bolimus, welcome to From the Bookshelf. It's nice to see you.
It's so nice to see you, Gary. Gary was in that same class.
Yeah, that's right. We were in the same class. And I was thinking back, I believe your big role was in Little Me.
Okay, so that's my Tom Lehrer story. That's the best one I have.
All right, good. Oh, you can tell me. Let me ask you this question first. What song, if you can remember, what song did you audition with? Do you remember?
I was Luck Be a Lady.
Ah.
From Guys and Dolls, which we did that year.
That's right. You and I did it.
But I played what I consider the worst part
in Guys and Dolls Brannigan. Like you'd be so happy to be one of the, you know, the gamblers.
I played Nathan Detroit, so I was totally happy.
Oh, there you go. But luckily I got to play that part in high school, so.
Oh, that's good. So you were, now when you were at UCSC, you were an actor, because I know he sort of wanted to draw people not from the drama department so much for his class.
Interesting. I don't think I had quite, I just started to do the, get into the acting. I hadn't done much of that in my freshman year. It was my sophomore year. And I was definitely a thespian, but I don't know. I auditioned and people seemed to like me and, you know, whatever. That was such a, didn't you just feel so privileged to be in that class?
Absolutely. Now I had, you know, kind of idolized Tom as a kid. What about you? Did you know his music and his stuff?
I mean, this sucks for everyone because there are huge fans out there, but no, I was not. I mean, I knew the Elements. I knew the song, The Elements. Uh-huh. You know, they had done it in the choir in my school and things like that. So
That's funny.
That was on my radar. I didn't really, you know him from Electric Company, but, you know, I know people grew up just reciting the word for word, those albums. I was not one of them. So really my first exposure to him was meeting him. I was such an idiot. You're like, I had no idea. Like what we were, you know, as I think I wrote to you in a text, like it was like being exposed to George Bernard Shaw or something. Like here's this like genius that I have access to.
Yeah.
So that's how it felt to me. But I don't know. I want to come back to Little Me.
Yes.
Eventually I'll tell that story.
Please do.
Okay. So, so one of our other classmates, Jenny Kaufman.
Jenny, yes.
She had the lead in that. And it was originally a vehicle for Sid Caesar, right? It was he played five to seven characters or something in it.
Mm-hmm.
But we split it up in our thing. And so I was playing this, you know, kind of German fascist director, you know, like a guy. And he's instructing her on how to play the scene. And he's... And she's going to, you know, like she's playing some character who's going to kill herself. And so, you know, I'm not satisfied with her performance. So I show her like with a knife, I say like, do it like this. And I stab myself. And then I turn and look around and say, oh, prop boy. And then die. So my story is that I was working on that scene with Tom and Jenny in this little like music room at Cowell, you know, like so tiny with just a little piano. And we were working, Tom wanted to work that bit out. Like he just wanted it to be perfect. So, you know, he's saying to me, and then turn to the left and then turn to the right and then look ahead and now say it, you know, like he had to like have it perfect timing, which we were just like in hysterics. And then my feeling that, you know, I felt good about was I think I decided like, oh, I think I'll do a little falsetto when I do that. So that was my contribution. And Jenny and Tom just started like hysterically laughing. and then he remembered that. So, I mean, like he relayed that back to me years later, said, remember that time we were in the music room with Jenny and, you know, and I was like, you remember that? I mean, I know I remember it because that's like one of my things, you know, one of my moments with you. But yeah, to know that it meant something to him too, that was really special.
Well, he always talked about you and followed your career and thought very highly of you. And occasionally you joined us when we watched, I think you came to an Oscar night one night and hung out with us.
Yeah, I mean, we got to watch the Tonys. I was just thinking you and Robin there every year for how many years did you do that?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, at least 25 years we watched the Oscars.
Incredible. I'm watching the Tonys with Tom Lehrer.
Yeah.
You know, and so for me, I think I did it a couple times, maybe two times.
Yeah.
And my wife Amy came once.
Oh, uh-huh.
But I was thinking, you know, just how he treated, like, he's so humble, you know, like he, I mean, he, treat me to breakfast sometimes. And then we go over there and he's like, oh, I got sushi for everybody. And, you know, like set us up with nice food. And
yeah. Yes.
Oh, he gave me a poster of Little Me, you know, as like he came over and he gave me that. I mean, there's something, what's funny to me is I know he gave me that poster, but no one else will ever know, you know, like I was kind of, it's kind of funny. Like, by the way, Tom Lehrer gave me this. They're like, oh, okay. You know, kind of funny. Like,
well, I mean, it is marvelous to know after his death this week that so many people loved him and cared about him. And I mean, all the major newspapers and magazines have covered his death. And yeah, that's great. I'm sure that's gratifying. It would be gratifying to him.
Yeah. I mean, he was really the, I mean, when I say like George Bernard, I don't say that lightly about, I don't know anyone else that was like him where he, like, I feel like a real genius is humble. Oh, he was humble. He was kind. He was always had something really interesting to engage about. Then he's funny. Like his humor is so funny. And
yeah, you know, he recently told a friend, they said, how are you? And he goes, well, I am suffering from longevity, but don't worry. It's not contagious. When I talked to him on his 97th birthday, he said, it's a lot like 96. But you mentioned him spending this time with you and Jenny in this music room, and every student who was ever in his class has this experience of working with him in a music room. I mean, he spent all 2 weeks each musical working with us and teaching us the songs and helping us learn how to sing them. And
amazing. You know, and then having, like, it's like your dream come true, right?
Yeah.
Like one rehearsal and then you put it on for a sold out crowd.
And then it's over.
What I never put together is, you know, at my young age, 19 or something, maybe 20, 19. That, you know, like there was Tom Lehrer playing the whole score for people. Like I thought they were coming to see us.
No. I doubt it.
It never occurred to me, like, you get to see Tom Lehrer play a full score of a musical, you know. And he always had a fun introduction and stuff.
Always, yes. It was a marvelous experience, and I'm glad we got to share it. And of course, I immediately thought of you, and you thought of me this week when we heard.
Yeah. I mean, I stayed. There's people that were close to me in that class. You know, that was very bonding.
It was like camp.
He also, I think another tradition of his was to invite all of his class over to his condo and then play. He was like, one time I will play my songs for you or something.
Yeah.
So we got that experience.
Yes. Yes.
Which was so neat. And then he also, one thing I remember from that is also that he said, well, I have, you know, I played this on the electric company and it was like Silent E.
Yeah,
I didn't play the dirty version, and then he played us a dirty version of the Silent E song, which nothing will be repeated here.
I hope we recorded that somewhere. Amazing. Well, Josiah Palemos, thank you so much for spending some time remembering him here on From the Bookshelf. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Gary. Thanks for inviting me.
Joining me now is songwriter Michael Gould, who was a longtime friend of Tom Lehrer's for over 50 years. Michael Gould, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
How did you meet Tom?
Actually, I was auditioning for Guys and Dolls in 1972, and Tom was playing piano for the auditions.
Oh.
And so that's when we met, and you know, we saw each other. I was in Guys and Dolls as a senior, I guess, and he got involved with looking at the show and coming to things. And
who did you play in Guys and Dolls?
I was Tony.
Oh, nice. Uh huh. And you were not in his musical comedy class.
No, I actually tried out, and I completely blew it in the in the audition, and people said, "Oh, that was great, that was great." I said, no, I should do another one." They said, no, leave that alone." And then Tom said, "I don't know what you were doing."
what song do you remember? What song you?
Oh, I think it was Swanee.
Oh, So you stayed friends. You were telling me earlier today that he was your mentor as a songwriter.
Yeah. We had a day together in April of 1976. And I was telling him about my recital and that was coming up. And I was an aesthetic studies major, which, for those of you who don't know, aesthetic studies was a major that was really kind of a fudge major for anybody whose artistic major didn't quite fit. At the time, I was really just starting to play piano, or at least when I started my junior year, I started playing piano. I had grown up playing accordion. So I invited him to my recital, and he came. And that night, he gave me a song to write. So he handed me a lyric after my recital and said, "Okay, make this into a song."
Oh, And what was the song called?
It's called "Thank Him for Me."
And is it a good song?
I think it was a good song, yeah. And I recorded it. I recently took the 16-track tape. We went into a studio and recorded.
Wow.
And, of course, I didn't show it to him before I did all that. And I'm kind of sorry about that, because it would have been more a collaboration rather than a handoff. But I went in with a bunch of really good musicians, and we put out this track, and then I brought it to him, and of course he didn't like it. and he had lots of questions why I did things, and of course I had the reasons. You know, I was able to answer, this is deliberate, you know. These were my thoughts. And unfortunately, I made a mistake in the lyric, which I have rued ever since. And, you know, I don't want to go back and re-record it. Although what I did recently is I went to a studio and brought the 16-track tape in, and they gave me 16 tracks back. Now I'm an audio engineer. So
you could just take the one little part and you could change the lyric.
I can't, because my voice is 50 years older than it was.
Can't AI,
I tried.
Yeah, maybe AI can play a part in this.
Well, I was just thinking that today. That maybe I'll just send the original track to AI, send me singing it today, that one line, and have it substituted in. So I'm going to finish out the track and republish it. And, you know, it wasn't a typical Tom Lehrer song, because it wasn't funny.
Right. Were you well familiar with Tom Lehrer's music before you became friends?
Absolutely. When I was a kid, I was at music camp up in upstate New York, and we had a counselor who would play Tom Lehrer's songs. And so I learned "Rickety Tickety Tin" from him, and I used to play that on the accordion and amuse my parents' friends all the time. When I got to high school, We moved from New Jersey, from Catholic school in New Jersey to public high school in Marin County. And boy, was it different. In my math class, the math teacher was playing New Math and then other songs from the That Was the Year That Was album. There was more exposure to him. And then, of course, I bought albums and listened. Became very familiar. So by the time I met him, you know, he was kind of an idol. And
a familiar story.
Yeah.
So after he helped you with that song, how did your partnership progress?
Well, we remained close friends, and I brought him everything. You know, I'm writing songs, and I'm really at the beginning of my songwriting exercise, and I'm a pop musician. The reason I got an aesthetic studies degree in the first place was because I wasn't going to be ready to play a classical recital in 2 years. So I kind of majored in songwriting. And but, you know, an undergraduate degree in songwriting, and it wasn't, you know, an accredited kind of thing. So I actually ended up being a creative director and writer for in ad agencies, and then had my own ad agency. And that's a different story. But so I would bring Tom all my songs and play them for him. And then he would stop me and say, okay, well, you know, this doesn't rhyme with that. Let's find a better thing there. Play me the melody. And I'd start playing the song on piano, and he'd say, no. Play me the melody. Just the melody. I don't want to hear any chord progression. I don't want to hear anything else, just the melody. And it forced me to really listen for the construction. You know, I always think of Bruce Springsteen, who is a wonderful performer, one of the worst melodists that ever lived. And, you know, he has a song called Pink Cadillac that has four notes in it. That's it. And most people don't notice that, but because of Tom sitting behind my ear all the time when I write, I'm hyper aware of it. You know, it's a different rule set than what Tom was accustomed to. And Tom is an old school writer. You know, he grew up with musical theater, and he grew up with cleverness being a primary feature of a good song. Whereas in our generation, saying something important about yourself or about a human feeling or a human emotion was a more valued asset. So the trick is to be able to fuse those things, as Stephen Sondheim did time and time again. I mean, he's so amazing at saying really important secret human truths out loud in incredible, clever rhyme that doesn't feel clever because it's so meaningful.
Yes. Yeah. And of course, Tom was a huge fan of Sondheim and of Broadway in general, but he did believe that the last good Broadway year was 1966.
I would beg to differ. I mean, but he was a fan of Hamilton. I think he liked Hamilton.
I liked Hamilton. I mean, he would find things that he liked on occasion, but generally speaking, he didn't like it when they started using microphones.
Right. he said that many times.
And you told me earlier when we were talking that you had planned to see him this week. So you definitely stayed friendly with him.
Yeah. And I'm supposed to see him tomorrow.
And how did you learn of his death?
His friend David called. And, you know, David and I had been making plans, and let's see each other while I'm there. I'm only going to be there for 2 days because I'm going to music camp on Friday up in the near Woodstock. So I thought, okay, I'll combine these two trips and see Tom for a couple of days and then off to music camp. So David knew that I was coming and called me and said,
It's a loss for us. I mean, it's just hard to believe that if someone could die at the age of 97 and for us to be shocked, because 97 is a very good age to be. But still.
Well, because he was in such good health too.
Yeah.
He was in perfect mental health. And, you know, and as I said earlier, he told me, how are you feeling, Tom? Well, I'm okay, other than a bad case of the 90s.
Well, Michael Gould, thank you for sharing your memories of Tom Lehrer with us here on From the Bookshelf. I appreciate it. And I hope you'll come back to the show and talk more about your music and career with us.
I'd love that.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.